This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldone. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 224 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. This week's episode is sponsored by ZipRecruiter. What if hiring could be easier, more streamlined, and less time-consuming? So even when you're busy, you could still be smart about the way you hire.
With ZipRecruiter, you can post your job to over 100 of the web's leading job boards with just one click. So you can rest easy knowing your job is being seen by the right candidates.
Then ZipRecruiter puts its smart matching technology to work, actively notifying qualified candidates about your job within minutes of posting, so you receive the best possible matches.
That's why ZipRecruiter is different. Unlike other hiring sites, ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on the right candidates finding you. It finds them.
No wonder 80% of employees who post on ZipRecruiter get quality candidates through the site in just one day.
Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by growing businesses of all sizes and industries to find the most qualified job candidates with immediate results.
And right now, our listeners can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free. That's right, free. Just go to ZipRecruiter.com/Outlander.
That's ZipRecruiter.com/Outlander. One more time, to try it for free, go to ZipRecruiter.com/Outlander.
ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire.
And now we have our listener feedback for episode 308, First Wife. First up is Amy D.
Hey, Ginger and Summer. It's Amy D with some feedback on First Wife. First of all, being back at Lallybroch was such a welcome homecoming, though it wasn't exactly a warm welcome for Claire. For viewers, well, for me at least, it was a return to my most favorite place for our two lovers to be. And knowing they won't be there for long made it that much more poignant and sweet. I just love Lallybroch. This episode had a lot of stuff to cover and deal with in order to propel them into the rest of the season. I thought the writers did a good job of hitting all the important high points, but also not dragging anything out. I thought they made quick, effective work of the other wife reveal, followed by Jamie being shot. And I didn't really miss the part from the book where Claire had run off and had to be dragged back after Leary shot Jamie in order to save his life. In fact, I rather liked that Claire witnessed the shooting and then shoved Leary away afterward. It was like, get your filthy hands off my husband. And I got a kick out of Claire being all territorial. Jenny is tough to like during this part of the story, and I'll admit to being quite pissed at her when I read this part of the book for the first time. I think this episode did a really good job of softening her, just a bit, just enough that I wasn't filled with contempt each time I looked at her. And that final scene between her and Claire, outside the house, where Claire tells her that she loves Jamie very much and that all she's asking for is a second chance. Well, Laura Donnelly played Jenny so well in those moments. Her eyes showed all of the fierce protectiveness that she feels toward her brother, but also her grief and sense of loss at having lost Claire, who she considered a sister. And I was so happy to hear the line, "Will you risk the man that I am for the sake of the man you once knew make a comeback?" I was disappointed when it wasn't in the reunion episode, but that week I saw a tweet from Meryl Davis that hinted it would pop up sometime later. I thought it was a lovely way to work it into the story, and though the scene on the cliff was a bit of a departure from the book, it was an appropriate and sweet addition, and it was absolutely gorgeous backdropped by the sea. One quick question. If Jamie couldn't swim back to the mainland with the treasure box when he found it after he'd escaped from Ardsmuir, how exactly was young Ian going to get back to shore with it? And that sailboat was absolutely breathtaking. And the final scene as the sails lowered one by one, wow. I can almost taste the adventure we're about to embark on. A couple of favorite lines from this episode. When Ian is speaking to Jenny as she's cleaning up the mess from Jamie and Claire's fight, and he says to her, "If there's a pot of shite on to boil, ye stir like it's God's work." So funny, and I love how Ian gets his wife. And then, after Jamie has been appropriately doctored by Claire and is convalescing, he asks for whiskey. Claire says, "You've had enough. You need liquids.
like water and broth. And he says, whiskey's a liquid. No, so funny. I love it when they inject little bits of humor in an otherwise serious situation.
And now, Andrea P.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. It's Andrea P. calling with feedback for First Wife. Hooray! We're back on track with a great episode of Outlander. I guess my comments are, I was thinking, why did Jamie go for Leary? Yes, those girls were stinking cute. Especially wee Joni. Man, just cut that girl's hair, give her a perm, and she's the next Annie on Broadway. So adorable. And I was thinking, Jamie is quite a broken man at this point. And he just wants somebody to love him, I think. And he sees Leary, and he thinks, well, this girl has loved me for decades, and this will be an easy fit. Not that he's thinking he's going to love her back, but he just wants to be loved and be in a family. So he thought it would be an easy fit. And when it turned out not to be, that's when, you know, he just ran away because he couldn't deal. Also, him throwing all that stuff back at Claire about, you know, leaving back through the stones. I think he was just mad at himself for making that decision in the end. A lot of regrets about that. And he was just blaming her because he couldn't deal with the fact that, you know, it was all on him. Anyways, I'm excited to be off on the high seas next week. So talk to you later. Bye.
Eileen P.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Eileen P. from Melville, New York. I know that you feel Jamie is wrong for blaming Claire for leaving him. I am reading this much differently. Jamie and Claire are soulmates who thought they would always be together and knew that was how it should have been. Rationally, Jamie Sinclair threw the stones, and Claire agreed to go through the stones to protect their unborn child. Jamie thought he would die in battle. When he didn't, he went through a wretched existence, first in the cave, then in prison, then in hell water, even married to Leary. He did that all without his soulmate. With each experience, he grieved the loss of Claire. He needed her. When he angrily blames Claire for leaving him, it is coming from a place of deep pain from being separated from his soulmate. How much you want to bet when Jamie thought of Claire in all those years without her? He thought, why couldn't she have been her stubborn self and stayed with me? When Jamie grieved for Claire, he went through the anger stage. It's normal to revisit it. You know what? I'm mad at Claire. Okay, she liked her life in Boston. Unfortunately, she seems to have forgotten that Jamie lived in a cave and in prison. Jamie is the king of men for not flinging that at her. That's it for now. Bye.
And Joe B.
Hi, it's Joe from Melbourne saying I really like 308. I think it hit what it needed to hit. I think it got us back on track after the debacle of last week. I think it's good that we've wrapped Leary up as well as we can and she needs to just move on, as we will. I love the fight scene. I love that scene. I think it's great that they're both able to just share their feelings and the hurt and the irrationality and the anger and the pain of losing each other can come out to the one person that actually really understands it. They can't tell Frank, they can't tell Jenny, they can't tell anyone else what it's been like for them. Lots of things about grief and how you feel even though you know it's not true. I also liked using birdsong to remind Claire of Jamie. I thought that was ironic considering he's tone deaf and can't sing a note. So I would also really like her to tell Jamie, use the words, I love you, or something like that. She needs to tell him, not everybody else around her. So, let's get out on the water, girls, and ahoy! Bye!
Martina P. writes, I loved this episode. My absolute favorite scene was Hogmanay at Lallybroch. Jamie's sad face, leaning against the door, observing the dancing and happiness, broke my heart. Loved Jamie's narration and the dancing movement going into slow motion. Wee Joni was so good, and she won everyone's heart with her red hair and her cute little voice. I totally forgave Jamie for taking on this family, and so did Claire. It was obvious by watching her facial expressions. The penicillin reveal should have happened in this episode when she actually needed it to save his life. It would have been fun and so much more effective to unpack it in this very moment. There was absolutely no reason to spoil it in the earlier episode. I actually feel the same way about the second wife. I remember what a shocker it was when the door opened and Marsali said, Daddy, who is that woman? That's the moment when my iPad glass shattered into pieces on the bathroom floor, the bathroom tiles, and I was trying to read through the cracks. I shared this story with you before, but what a complete shocker it was, and I somehow wished that non-book readers could have had the same experience. Have you guys noticed Sam's subtle Jamie mannerisms? I sometimes wonder if they are scripted or if he adds those on his own initiative. I think the latter might be true. He was tapping his fingers before entering Lallybroch, or when he was on the operating table, the lopsided smile in his sleep. He often squares his shoulders when he is uncomfortable. I love it when he does that. I actually enjoy the scenes when Jamie and Claire fight. They do it so well and so passionately. Can we really say that Claire is right when she says that he lied to her? I might want to argue that he didn't. Back in the reunion episode, while in bed, he made an attempt to talk, and she actually cut him off by saying, quote, "We don't have to talk now. All I want to know is if you have ever fallen in love since I left," unquote. And he answered truthfully. Can he be called a liar in this case? I would say not. Lying by omission, is that even possible? I must say that absolutely all cast members performed exceedingly well in this episode. Young Ian is so good, and I just can't wait to see what he will bring to the screen going forward. Off to the Caribbean with the adventures and craziness. It will be great fun. And now, Lisa T.
Greetings, lasses. It is the intrepid Lisa T. I just had my wee thoughts on 308 First Wife. First of all, this was the ep that I was looking forward to most. I know everyone's like, print shop, but I was like, oh, no, this one when all the fur flies. So I loved it. Did not disappoint. The funniest, best line, I think, was Ian talking to Jenny about stirring the shite pot like it was God's work. I thought that was absolutely hilarious. I love Stephen Cree as Ian. The other observation I wanted to make, it actually amplifies the scene from Ep 306 when Claire and Jamie are talking about their children, and Claire mentions that Bree has red hair, and he says, yes, like her sister Faith. Well, when he took a look at Wee Joni when at Hogmanay, I think, you know, it that line just was much more amplified. Looking at little wee redheaded Joni, you know, for him was like, my gosh, maybe this is the closest I'll ever see to what Faith might have looked like. So I just thought that was just so poignant, and just his scenes with her, you could see right away why he wanted to be a father to those girls. So anyway, I've loved seeing Nell Hudson. She always makes it fun. So you just love to hate her. She's great. Those are my wee thoughts. Have a great, great podcast. Thanks. Bye.
Megan P.
Hi, Megan here. I am so much happier with this episode than I was last week's. And I'm reminding myself just to not be long-winded, as I got cut off last week when I was leaving feedback. Just a couple things, because I know everyone says similar things. Little Joni was precious. She sounded a little Irish to me. Her accent did. It wasn't very Scottish sounding to me. Maybe I was wrong, but it came off Irish to me. Couldn't be mad at Jenny. I just related so much to her feelings, even though it was much more personal to her hurt feelings than it was to Jamie's. I can kind of relate. I have a sister-in-law that's just like Jenny, and I just could see the whole thing playing out. But I definitely don't approve of her underhanded methods. But that's kind of the way a lot of women are, yeah? I don't know. Maybe I've had bad luck with women in my life. But they're usually pretty mischievous and sneaky and underhanded when it comes to hurt feelings and getting revenge. But, yeah, definitely better than last week. So I was pleased overall. Love you guys. Love watching the live after the episode. It's so much fun. Keep doing what you're doing. You guys have a great day.
Michael M.
Howdy, Ginger. Howdy, Summer. This is Michael from Shawnee, Kansas, with my thoughts for Outlander Episode 308. My first thought is, it was very good. I believe it to be one of the better adaptations this season. I would put it in the top half of all episodes for Season 3. We learned that Claire can be just as snarky as Summer. My favorite line from this episode was when she was replying to Jamie about Leary when he said, "You told me to be nice to her." Her reply was perfect. She said, "I said thank her, not marry her." Now let's talk about Jenny. I was not a fan of what book Jenny did to Claire at this part of the story. I can sympathize with show Jenny. I think Laura Donnelly did an excellent job portraying Jenny, how hurt she was, how betrayed she felt because Claire didn't didn't bother to even write. My final thought for this feedback is a description of a name, and the name is Marcely. Now, there are two issues with her name. One is it pronounced with two syllables or with three? Is it Marcely or Marcely? Either way, I think Marsali is putting the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
Marlo R. writes, "Hi, Ginger and Summer. I wanted to give some quick feedback on episode 8, First Wife. I love this episode, and I am continuing to enjoy the adaptive changes that they are making so far. I like how they are really showing both in this episode and in episode 7 the real impact of Claire's return, and how hard it was for everyone, and that it impacted a lot of people, not just Jamie and Claire. I think the struggle of Jamie and Claire's reconnection is very realistic, and I feel for both of them. So happy to be reunited, yet struggling with the impact of what that reunion does to everything and everyone around them. Claire's return literally upset Jamie's whole life, and he has to live in this new life while Claire left her life behind. Along with all the disruption, it also brought to light all of the feelings of sadness and loneliness that he had kept bottled up for so long by living in a shadow. He is trying to come to grips with all of that, and it is hard, but he is working through. And I love seeing Sam do such an amazing job working through those conflicted emotions. When she asks him if he blames her from coming back, and he says no, yes, God, no. It was just brilliant, heartbreaking, and very realistic. Her reappearance completely turned his life upside down in a matter of a few days, so there is bound to be some angst. But we know he wants her there more than anything, but maybe a little less chaos to go along with it. I like that they have added a bit more tension between Jamie and Claire in the past two episodes, and the fighting and jealousy that occurs between them seems to just be a result of all the emotions that they are trying to come to terms with. Now that they know the other is alive and safe, they are trying to deal with all the sadness of missing out on the life they should have had together. I think this added tension is completely realistic, and I always felt the books made it look a little too easy after 20 years apart and all they went through. I appreciated the change and having Jamie trying to tell Claire about Leary, which in reality is all we book readers would have really wanted Jamie to do. Just tell her already and stop keeping secrets. Of course, they couldn't have him tell her, as we need the drama and the dramatic reveal. I loved all the bits with Jenny. Her dynamic with Jamie is still the best. I love it when he calls her Janet. You can tell things are heated. The fact that Jenny knew there was more to the stories Jamie and Claire were telling and kept pressing for the truth was a great addition. It shows that she knows both of these people and loves them, and the thought of them lying to her is devastating and difficult to forgive. And really, this is what the whole episode is about: lying and the impact of those lies on those you love. Jamie has been lying to everyone, and by the end of the episode, I feel like he has learned his lesson. That is, until he tells Jenny and Ian that young Ian will be safe, and you can trust us. LOL. Hilarious. And now, Sandy C.
Hi, Ginger and Summer. This is Sandy from Oregon. Just wanted to give my two cents on episode 308. I really think this was a great episode. I think there was a lot of little things that made it so wonderful, and it felt real, and the fight between Claire and Jamie was so heart-wrenching and just real and authentic. But one of the things that was really bothering me about this episode was I want to know what people kept thinking that Jamie lied about. It seemed like Claire was accusing him of lying about not loving anybody else, but he told her over and over again, "I have never loved anybody but you." And he definitely didn't lie about being married to somebody else, because technically they never really talked about that. She started to ask him at one point and then stopped and said, "No, we don't need to talk about that right now." And then that was when she initially said, "Did you fall in love with anybody else?" And he said no. So technically, he never did lie. It was a secret, yes. Should he have told her sooner? Absolutely. But was it a lie? No, I don't think so. So I think people are a little too hard on Jamie saying that he lied about this when he really didn't. But I really felt like the relationship really played out. The fear and all of the just hard times and everything that was between them. And I hope that we get kind of that final reconciliation that got cut off by the viewing of the boat. Thanks. Talk to you later. Bye.
Sarah V.
Hello, guys. This is Sarah from Chile, South America. Just a quick message to say that I didn't like this episode at all. I'm glad that they didn't change, that young Ian was kidnapped. But that's about all. It was very boring. your podcast is way, way more entertaining than this episode. So I am looking forward to your podcast, and I hope the next episode is much, much more entertaining. Thank you.
Susan Y.
Hi, Summer. Hi, Ginger. This is Susan from Northern Maine. It's the second time I've called. I listened to your podcast earlier this week, and there was, you guys, there was a statement about not something that Diana Gabaldon didn't write, and something you had said that this is something that Jamie never would have said. And I wanted to just play you a portion of the audiobook because he does say it in the book.
Hitting him again and again and again, the sound of the blows thudding against his chest. Why? 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 Because I was afraid. He got hold of my wrists and threw me backwards so I fell across the bed. He stood over me, fists clenched, breathing hard. I'm a coward, damn you. I couldn't tell you for fear you would leave me. And unmanly thing that I am, I thought I could not bear that. Unmanly? With two wives? Ha! I really thought he would slap me. He raised his arm, but then his open palm clenched into a fist. Am I a man? To want you so badly that nothing else matters. To see you and know I would sacrifice honor or family or life itself to lie with you, even though you'd left me. You have the filthy, unmitigated, bleeding gall to say such a thing to me?
I think that was the part that you guys thought was not Jamie Fraser about the, even though you left me. So he does say that to her, which is kind of weird, but he does in the book as well as in the show. Anyway, love your podcast, and I'm going to keep listening to it, and hope you're having a great week. Thanks a lot. Bye.
Linda G. writes, Hi, Ginger and Summer. OMG, I loved this episode. I want to say it's one of my favorites so far. Not very happy with Jenny. I just wanted to slap her, but in all fairness, she knows there is something Claire is hiding. My favorite part is the fight between Jamie and Claire. I almost wished Jenny throwing the water didn't happen. I wanted to see the sexy part go all the way. Yep, I'm a dirty old lady. Ned, oh Ned, he was great, giving Claire some much-needed love. And now, leg hair. Wow, using the C word was a little harsh, but then again, that lass is cray-cray. Love the scene with the daughter, Joan. Now we know who Jamie was holding in all those teaser pics that were circulating. A very sweet scene. They sure have aged Ian quite a bit. I so adore him. I guess it was necessary for the age look considering who he is married to. Was it just me, or was wee Jamie a bit obnoxious to Claire? I love young Ian. What's not to love? I can't wait for all the adventures that are about to happen with Jamie and Claire. Then maybe, just maybe. I love your podcast as always, and want to know a secret? I pulled over on the freeway to catch the live after show on Sunday. Shh. Oh, Linda. Be ever so careful. There's always a replay.
So for those of our listeners that stick with us all year round, they're very familiar with this next theme. It has accompanied almost every chapter of our Voyager read-along. And now, since we've taken on the voyage, the main voyage.
What Summer's trying to say is we're finally on the GD boat.
Okay. Well, since we're finally on the GD boat. Good Lord.
And by that, we mean Ginger drama.
We thought it was time for our sea shanty. So, without further ado, now on to our episode discussion of 309, entitled The Doldrums.
Episode 309, The Doldrums, was written by Shannon Goss, another new writer, and directed by David Moore. Now, the last episode left us with Jamie and Claire on the edge of a cliff or on a something of Scotland overlooking the Selkies Island, where young Ian, whom Jamie had just promised to take care of, period, end of story, got kidnapped, along with the jewels, money, treasure chest, everything. That's how we left it. So now we go on. But first, this opening title.
Oh my gosh.
Okay, I watched it and I almost said phone a friend. No, we did not phone a friend. Actually, no, I may have texted Summer this, not discussing anything, not asking any questions,
But I may have texted you. But if I didn't, here's what I would have said.
I'm going to stop you there. You texted me a lot of cryptic to which point I responded. Each time I went, huh? And you're like, I'll fill you in tomorrow. And I'm like, oh my God, I hate you right now. How dare you send me all these cryptic things and not fill me in?
Because you're not supposed to talk about it. I thought you would know what I meant. I have barely gotten through this new intro and I'm crying. So this intro. Okay, so the music is much slower and we get a lot more drums. And if you remembered, no, we hadn't heard it at that point. If you remembered what I said at the end of 308, there were drums at different points. We had a little bit of this kind of thing when Jamie swam to the island, a little bit when Ian swam to the island and they were watching him, and then a little bit at the end when it started picking up, but totally in this intro.
Yes, there were lots of drums in the intro. I love the new intro. I love it. I love it. I love it. I love the imagery they added.
It's so pretty. The drums start in at about Mary of Soul and accompany a view of what appear to be palm fronds. It's like, it's not, it's big, like long, skinny leaves. No. And then we get an underwater view. And then we get someone crawling up onto the beach. And it must be Claire because of the hair and the ring she has on and the shape of the long, slim fingers. Then just before we go to the dancing druids, we get some African dancing. And I don't mean like some person, an African person. I mean, she probably is, maybe, but it's African dancing, or I believe what's supposed to be African dancing. And then a shot of water being spilled over some bloody feet and lower leg. We can guess about that, but we're not going to. Then Claire is holding her hand, probably the one wearing Jamie's ring. And then we get a view looking up at some dead bodies prepared to be dropped overboard. And they're all decked in some kind of flag. And then more African dancing. And then I wrote, someone helping Claire get dressed. I have a guess who this might be, but I could be wrong. It was definitely a female. Or it didn't have to be Claire, but I thought it was Claire because of the length of the torso. She was tall. And the person helping her was much shorter. And the dress looked fancy. And then it's dark, we're on a beach, and it looks like Jamie's arm, which is clad in a black jacket, is reaching for Claire's hand. Then we get a view of the back of Claire, her head bound up in some rag of her clothing, staggering through the island. And that is without, I can say this and it's not a spoiler because it's meaningless to anyone who hasn't read. That is the mangroves, right?
Possibly. We'll see.
Possibly. And then we get more druids dancing. Whenever I say druids dancing like this, I want to say, nine druids dancing.
We're almost to that season.
So I know, huh? And then there's a carriage with what I'm guess is a slave, or who I'm guess is a slave as its driver. So probably an African male. And then Claire is washing her hands in a basin next to Fergus's wooden hand. And then I think what looks like turtle soup. Okay, we're not going to say what happens and what that means, but I think it's the episode of Turtle Soup. It looks like Jamie and Claire are naked, or at least she's naked or nude or has nothing on, at least on the shoulders. And he's running a rag down over her lips. And you don't see her eyes really, but it's very smexy. And they appear to be naked, as I said. Then we have more dancing and torches lit. Then we're on some kind of deck that is drenched by seawater. Then a look at our beloved Claire, bedraggled, alone, on a beach, looking out over the ocean. And we end with druids dancing. Nine druids dancing. And then an aerial view of the Artemis. I am loving what they've done with this intro, Summer. This gives Bear a chance to change. I love what they're doing. And I don't mean this one. I mean all of them. It gives Bear, the show as well, the show benefits, but it gives Bear a chance to change it up each time and make it not only season appropriate, but also episode appropriate where applicable. The title card of the Doldrums is actually a view of the Artemis, the ship that Jamie and Claire are about to take to the Indies, and its crew is prepping to sail. Now, about that title, the Doldrums is a, this is from Wikipedia, this is a quote, and I will provide the link in the show notes. The Doldrums is a colloquial expression derived from historical maritime usage, which refers to those parts of the Atlantic and Pacific Oceans affected by a low-pressure area around the equator, where the prevailing winds are calm. The Doldrums are also noted for calm periods when the winds disappear altogether, trapping sailing ships for periods of days or weeks. The term appears to have arisen in the 18th century when trans-equator sailing voyages became more common. Since this zone is where two trade winds meet, it's also called the intertropical convergence zone. So we get a little bit of an explanation of what it means. And I think there's, we'll see, or at least I'll bring it up later. I saw the literal meaning and then also metaphorical meaning at some point in the episode of what I thought anyway. So let's get this party started. The two clues that we have that this is Scotland and not France, like the book, actually three clues. Number one, as they're sailing away, Jamie says, you know, he's looking at Scotland is enough for him right then. Claire was worried he was going to be sick. And he's like, right now, I only have eyes for Scotland. I don't aim to be back without Ian. I won't be stepping foot on it again without Ian. That was the first thing.
Well, he wouldn't be alive long if he died to.
Exactly. The second thing is when you get Marsali and Fergus, because that definitely in the book, it definitely happened as they were leaving Scotland to go to France to meet with Jared and still look up this other ship. What I mean by the second one is that the fact that it was Fergus and Marsali and everybody else who was being loaded, because they were loading the boat right there, and we saw that it was the Artemis. So wherever they were obviously leaving from. So bringing Marsali onto the Artemis and having it be a surprise, there's no way she could have stowed away on a ship from Scotland to France and then have it be a surprise that she was loaded, what, and luggage from Lallybroch? No. So all the stuff from Lallybroch was another clue. And the final one is when Frank, you know that scene with Frank?
That there was not one week. I know that because I didn't hear his
name. I know. That's true. So the third one is that when Jamie says, I think he says it to Claire, he says, so Jenny still thinks that we're going to France. Mm. So if they're not already in France, then and him saying that means they're not going to go, even if that, and it was the plan, but it was the plan before Ian got kidnapped. Okay, so they're in Scotland, and I can kind of get it kind of along the lines of not showing Claire take off to the stones. You just don't need it. It saves time. It's a whole other voyage. So I get it. Believe me, there's plenty for me to talk about in this episode. Not just that's like this, that's nothing. It's interesting though. Two things are interesting, I guess, is that Jared happens to be there because we don't know if, you know, did they send someone across to find him and bring him back? I have no idea.
Maybe they got to the port town and were going to sail that way and he happened to be there. Who knows? He might be summering or wintering in northern Scotland. I don't know.
So Jared somehow is there. But also, okay, so I guess if you're going to do without France entirely, then it's not a stretch at all to have the record of ships in ports be not in France. So if you're depending on this port in Scotland, then you're depending on that and that's it. In the book, in the book and the show, they rely on Jared to do a little bit of work for them, right? A little bit of investigative work. Because in both places, Jared tells them that they knew it was a Portuguese ship, or at least he says the only Portuguese ship was the Bruxa.
That was fun to hear.
Not only do I not speak Spanish, I don't speak Portuguese. So the Bruxa. So they still use Jared in the exact same way. It was just took place in Scotland. Jared allows them to be passengers on one of his ships that's going to the Indies, of course, the Artemis, in return for Jamie being its supercargo. And this is where, after the intro, I teared up for the first time in the episode because that's not a sexy word or anything. Don't get me wrong. But that is like legit his title in the book. And so hearing it and seeing it is like,
awesome. I totally wrote that down and had like four exclamation points after it. I was like, supercargo!
Oh, you did? Oh, it's so funny. It makes me so happy.
Supercargo!
The supercargo, of course, is a person who he's in charge of the goods. During transportation, I mean, yeah, but his role becomes most important once they get wherever they're going, because he's in charge of the unloading of the goods and then he's free. Actually, that's not true. We didn't learn about it here. I mean, it doesn't mean that it's not going to happen. But remember, this is Jared's ship, and it doesn't. It's not going on a, you know, on a.
It's not a pleasure.
On a fun time trip. No. Exactly. He's got goods. He's a businessman. He's got goods to sell and or trade. Who knows? But also probably picking up stuff. So at least in the book, Jamie was the supercargo on the way over to the Indies. And his job was twofold, not only to oversee the unloading of the cargo and making sure it meets its correct destination, but also to, if Jared has made arrangements or has plans to use either his own capital or money made from the sale of his goods to load up again before going back to France, because you don't want to waste any trip, right? It's so expensive and such a big undertaking that you don't just go one way with stuff. You're doing things both ways. So if they keep it like the book, even if it's not the same stuff in the book, I don't think it's really spoilery at all. In the book, it was bat guano was what he loaded up with, right, Sam?
Yes.
We didn't know if they're going to do that, but you know, just in case you're interested, it was bat guano. Was it just me or, okay, I got over it real quick. But when I saw the ship, or damn, that's a small boat.
Well, I didn't think that at all until I saw the British Man of War. And then I was like, dang, that's a small boat. But not
see,
until I
must have predictive powers because I was just like, it's a boat. Respect. But it's not really a big boat. But whatevs. Claire, of course, will be the physician on board. And when Jared says that she'll be able to help when Jamie begins to retch, Jamie looks shifty and says, I'll manage. Now, the first time through, I didn't think he looked shifty. I thought he looked like, oh, can we please not talk about me barfing? Mm-hmm. It's not very manly.
I'm going to talk about his barf later.
After the second watch. So what I wrote was, when Jared says that as a physician, she'll be able there to be there to help Jamie when he retches, I wrote, he looks shifty-eyed and says, I'll manage. Again, the shifty-eye thing does not make sense. Until you watch it a second time. Because the first time at the beginning, you're like, oh, what is? I don't think shifty, but now I do. There's a reason. So there, as I said, there was only record of one ship sailing under a Portuguese flag.
No, there were guys in there and they were from Portugal. So they were Portuguese.
A Portuguese flag. So we missed the flag last week. But I did read online that fans noticed it and had identified. I was like, dang, you guys go. And that ship, of course, was the Bruxa. And we pronounced it all wrong during the read-along.
We don't
can't believe do no we have one any Portuguese us listeners people.
Or people who speak Portuguese. No, if no one corrects us, we don't know better.
Oh, no. I know that. I'm not saying that it was our fault. I mean, it was our fault because we didn't know, but and I'm not mad. I'm just like, really? We do have listeners from all around the world, and I don't like to pronounce things incorrectly, as you guys might have been able to tell again. The last few weeks. I was pronouncing it like Spanish H, like the J, the H, but it's Bruxa, okay. Not Bruja. But yeah, it still means witch. It means witch, right? No one said anything about that. Okay, so they believe young Ian, who was on the Bruxa, will be sold for a good price in Jamaica. And since he'll be treated relatively well, as long as he doesn't get himself into trouble, they believe he'll be fine on the journey. So yeah, he's kidnapped and yeah, he'll be sold likely into slavery.
Why does Jared know so much about how much boys go for?
About slavery?
Yeah.
Probably because he's been to the Indies before. He knows how it works.
And he knows an awful lot about the prices
about young white boys?
Of young white boys. I think Jared's got some backstory that Diana needs to write about.
So they have a chat and Claire deflects. Jamie says, if you really want to go home, I'll take you to the stones myself. And she says, what's important right now is that we find young Ian.
Seriously.
I was like, okay, Claire.
She's like, I'm not going to give you an answer yet. You're not off the hook, but this is more important right now. We'll talk about it later.
Young Ian is where it's at. Exactly. Then it's time to go.
Okay. Two things. Not two things. Maybe more than that. But I would like to say, one, I put down West Indies. We've heard that before, so it's probably, you know, someplace, you know, we've heard about before we're going to go in this season. So we heard that earlier from not the Reverend, the non-Reverend and his sister. We're going to the West Indies.
The non-Reverend, yes.
And now they are headed towards the West Indies. I also wanted to note that I believe that for people saying that they didn't age Claire and Jamie enough physically –
oh,
this episode is going to highlight the ways in which they have been, because a majority of the scenes so far have taken place inside in darkly lit rooms. And because a lot of their aging makeup has been put in the creases and cracks of their eyes, they're squinting a lot outside. So they all of their little smile wrinkles next to their eyes that they have been gifted with by the makeup department are all very visible in this episode numerous times. But I do want to know, how long did it take them to get to this town? Her hair grew like 6 inches.
To this town?
Yeah, to the port.
You mean the
wherever
coast?
Wherever they are, wherever they went and met with Jared, she had like a shoulder, like less than shoulder length, not even to her shoulder, almost to her shoulder length bob. And it's like 2 or 3 inches below her shoulders now. That's a lot. I can't grow that much hair in a year.
So it's time to go. So Jamie's two men are there. We learn how, I did not catch it the first time. I caught it the second time. Did you hear how Hayes at least came to be with Jamie? He actually...
Was he the Ardsmere one? He shipped over and came back.
He did go to the colonies as an indentured servant, and then he returned. Now, I don't know if that's after serving his time or escaping. Who knows? But that's when he made contact with Jamie, probably in or around Edinburgh. And Fergus, we learn, is also coming along on this journey, of course, along with some baggage from Lallybroch, some clothes and supplies. Yeah. So Claire saying, quote, since Jenny and Ian think we're still headed to France, dot, dot, dot. Okay. So this isn't France. No. So it's definitely, it's definitely Scotland. And that was pretty obvious when Fergus showed up with his baggage. Of course, we know what that means. Now, I love the sea. I love, it's a nice touch with the men touching the horseshoe. I think that was the whole thing about not going to France. The whole thing about, you know, all these things, they're different, but they're cool. They make sense. Saving time, trying to make like a little, this episode by using the horseshoe, it helped frame the episode. It helped give it tension and drama and serve a purpose for bringing something about. Which was done well, but did not have the desired effect, I don't believe, but I'll get to that later. So, Claire saying, we'll find him, along with the theme of the new world, makes me think of Last of the Mohicans.
Huh. We'll find him! No matter what occurs, I will find you.
So, along with the horseshoe, women and redheads are bad luck on ships. And, yes, Claire, you are invisible. not for long, though. And I love, once again, just like we got the bejesus, just like we got the beat, Jamie to walk under the Bee Gees down the streets of Edinburgh, I love Jamie in a tricorn. He looks really nice. So some of the baggage that Fergus brought was a little lady named Marsali. So yeah, that was, and they're married.
No, she is perfect. She is so perfect. Like, they've written her. The lines they gave her are, I mean, I'm fairly sure that most of them are pretty close to out of the book.
Yeah.
So she was written very well by Diana, but they captured the character that Diana made perfectly. Perfectly.
I agree 95%. And there are things that just rub me the wrong way about... The look is perfect. She looks so much like Leary. It's ridiculous. And I think she is a perfect Marsali. I'm not saying she's not.
Well, let's put it this way. She's not playing her as bratty as the book.
Oh, no. She's playing her plenty bratty.
No,
plenty
but it's bratty. Not, no, but the book always kind of came across with a, and maybe that's just the way I read it, that she came across kind of like, I want my way. I'm a brat and I'm going to do this and I'm going to, she was always undermining everything.
Yes, she does seem a little more mature than that.
And maybe that's intentional because in the book she was how old? 14?
15.
So I think they maybe she's, what is she? Maybe do we know how old she is in this adaptation?
I don't know okay. For sure.
Anyway.
No. But I'll talk later about what bugs me about Marsali. And it's not the writing. I don't want to talk about it until it's time because there's a specific thing she does at a certain time that in a certain scene that will make sense, I think, later on. So she has got some kind of lip. I must say I like her spunk. And just like the book Marsali, she's smallish and she gives great eye roll. Marsali was absolutely wonderful casting, but she doesn't seem as innocent as she was in the books. Now, I'm not saying virginal. I'm saying, and this is why it's hard for me to put into words, I don't know the right term. She seems, maybe I'm misremembering her, but anyway, this whole scene, she seems too put together. She seems too, not too comfortable with herself, because that's not necessarily.
You don't think she's Marsali naive
or
enough?
Not Marsali. You might have, yeah, that's part of it. She's definitely not naive enough. And again, I don't mean knowledge of the world. I just mean in her mannerisms, I guess. I don't know. I just don't think she's played as naive as she at least was in the book. Now, she's a little older, we believe, and that could have been on purpose. I don't know. But it wasn't, again, it wasn't the writing. So the whole scene is delightful. Pretty much seems to be straight from the books. And it was awesome seeing it come to screen.
Dude, the moment when Jamie says that they're going to be split sharing rooms and they both turn and said what at the same time in tandem was perfection. So perfect. I loved it.
Finally, we see a sick Jamie. So Claire brings him her ginger tea. She sees the trunk in the room that has her clothes from Paris. Mm. And she's really surprised that Jamie kept them. And he says he couldn't sell them as they were memories of her.
I love that he kept them.
Exactly. This is an example of a change from the book that is freaking awesome.
And I spent the rest of the episode checking her clothes out. I'm like, is that new?
Oh, me too.
What's that? When did she wear that? That dress looks familiar.
It was a brilliant change. Number one, it saves them time and money. Yeah. They don't have a lot of money right now. They just lost their treasure.
Right.
So Marsali, he says, has altered a few items to wear. And again, that I'm not like, oh, Marsali took a clip. No, who gives a crap? She was supposed to be dead. So just like Claire doesn't care, I don't care. So I am not anti-Marsali. I love Marsali and Fergus. I love them. I'm just, we were just like last week to me doesn't count for getting to know Marsali because we didn't get to know her. Now we're getting to know her. This counts big time. So anyway, what I'm trying to say is Jamie says that Marsali had altered a few and Claire's like, yeah, I thought I might have recognized that cloak or something.
She was like, well, she didn't alter them all, did she? Could you imagine? Yeah. She would have cut off like 2 feet off of that dress. Okay.
She's like 2 feet shorter. Exactly. Then we have the entrance of the, I would say drama, the main conflict for this episode. And that is the based on the superstition, on superstitions or superstitious sailors. Claire is called away from Jamie to nurse her first injured man. And this is Mansetti. Now, I know there was a dude in the book on the ship named Mansetti.
In the book. Absolutely. I looked it up today. I saw it. He was on the ship. He was a dude on their ship. Mansetti.
So I do remember the name. The men refuse to believe that this injury was an accident. They're not saying that someone caused it on purpose. They're saying that it happened because someone didn't touch the horseshoe. They don't believe accidents happen. Now, the captain, he has I do not envy him. His job is to keep his men safe and get them to their destination in one piece and, of course, the cargo.
And without mutiny.
Yes. Here, the captain is backing up the beliefs of the men. And this makes sense as he's standing before them. In order not to talk shop publicly, he invites Claire and Jamie to dine with him. Now, this first night is Claire only since Jamie is a bit under the weather.
Right.
So Jamie and Fergus have a heart-to-heart while Claire's ostensibly, I guess, eating with the captain or around this time, or maybe while she's out on the deck. Jamie and Claire have a heart-to-heart about Marsali. Jamie's concerned not just because of Marsali's mom, and he's like, I don't want any more. You don't understand. I barely got out of there. I don't want any more problem. But also, he's afraid that one or both of them may get hurt, may have their hearts broken, and then she'll be ruined and all this because she doesn't know, he doesn't think that they know enough about each other to make this kind of decision. He says that Fergus, you hardly know her. And I wrote, I like Fergus's hair. I'm sorry. Seriously. César is, I think, my new, I'm not comparing him at all. I think he's my new, no, yeah, I think he's my new friend, not Frank, excuse me, my new Tobias. Him or David?
Not David Barry, man. David Barry is the perfect substitute because he's also a red coat.
Oh, that's true. Oh, he has a uniform. Crap, you're right.
He has a uniform.
So, blah, 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 blah. Fergus says he was a coward, but he says he and Marsali don't have secrets from each other. Now, the way Fergus cocks his head and looks away and says no, but when Jamie asks him if she knows about his other lasses.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Exactly, Fergus. Exactly. Jamie names the litany of Fergus's recent dames.
<Mm-mm>.
He says he hasn't lain with Marsali nor any other woman since they began courting. Jamie says, you must be honest with her.
Yeah, we saw how not being honest went for Jamie. He got shot.
Oh, Lord.
Left him.
Well, see, the thing about Jamie is he was selectively honest, and that was also didn't work.
That's almost worse, being selectively honest.
Summer, we talked about this. It is worse. I went on a rant in our show and on the live after show. I ranted.
Okay.
Which I don't do much.
Yeah. You've been doing it a lot this season. Creme de menthe.
So Claire is having dinner with the captain, and I wrote, Claire finally changes after how many months back?
I know. And that was the first dress. I was like, have I seen that before? I feel like I've seen that dress before.
All it looked was dark.
I know, but she had a dark, like, green dress that was kind of wool looking. But it had a different stomacher. Is that what that's called? The thing that goes in the front?
You mean the one she wore to sleep with the king, right?
No. I'm talking about, it might have been even a season one dress, but I think it had like a flower embroidered stomacher. It looked kind of like that one to me. And I was like, is that the same green dress? But I don't know. But that might have been, I don't know if she kept that one or if these were just her dresses from France. And if it was just her dresses from France, I don't think she had any wool dresses. Every dress she had in France was like shiny.
Yeah, satiny. Captain Rains is educating her on the superstition of sailors. Women are ill luck. She and Marsali should be bare-breasted to calm the sea. That was something I did not know about, but it makes sense because if you've ever seen pictures of old ships or paintings, the figurehead is always a woman with bared breasts on the bow. And he says, unfortunately, the horseshoe has no substitute. So he says, having a figurehead with bared breasts calms the sea and keeps them from being cursed. And that's instead of a woman on ship with bared breasts. But he says, unlike the bare-breasted woman, the horseshoe has no substitute. It has to be hit. And so Claire has a point in that if something bad happens, men can also lose faith. But the captain says he would still rather have them make their luck. It doesn't matter if he believes the horseshoe works. It matters that they do. So the captain is actually, I think, the smarter of the two people at this table right now.
He's the smarter of the two because, and I mean, he is clearly on a higher caste than the sailors. So he is a more educated individual, I believe, than the sailors.
Oh, yeah.
And he, instead of trying to mold the world around him, he acclimates to it and tries to make the best of what he's been dealt, whereas Claire tries to force her world into the way that she would like it to be, and that rarely works for her.
Yes. 20th century Claire, believing something doesn't make it real, and she's not incorrect-ish. 18th century Captain Rains, he says, on this ship, it does. So Claire, yet again, not only forgets her time, but also her location. Because Claire was not this stuck or stubborn the first time she went back. I mean, right away, maybe, yes, but by the time she left Scotland and went back, to Frank, she was much more in tune with the time. She is still fighting to fit in. You know what I'm saying? She's still fighting her 20th century-ness, which is difficult because, you know, that's where she was for quite a few years. Yuck. Now Jamie is barfing.
Oh, dude, it looked like egg whites. It looked like he legitimately...
It was egg whites.
It looked like he literally just like vomited, like had a mouthful of egg, of a raw egg, and just spit it out of his mouth.
But I thought that's what he said that he did.
I don't think it was supposed to be. Wasn't he drinking ginger?
No, I'm saying the actor, Sam Heughan, in an interview said they used egg whites.
Well, good, because that's exactly what I saw. But I didn't read that interview, so I'm just going based on what I could see. And I've never vomited in such a way that brought up egg whites.
It looked like egg whites? The thing about, I don't disagree. The thing about vomiting is if you don't have like a lot of food or any food in your stomach and it's... It was much too much stuff to be like a lot of spittle or anything.
I have vomited up bile before, and it never had that much viscosity.
Jamie has magic bile.
I'm going to have to let you have that one.
Okay, so finally we see a literally sick Jamie, and in peaks Mr. Willoughby. He says, quote, how long will you continue this farce? And at first you're like, wait, a farce? He's obviously not farcing.
Right.
He's barfing.
Barfing. They're not interchangeable.
So this is something they've either done before together or something at least that Jamie knows Willoughby can do. He's at least offered help before, which we don't get to, you know, right now. But that was a little kind of, you know, peek behind the curtain into a, what's this about? In the end, the way they adapted it made sense for Claire to think it was her tea. But it was kind of funny seeing the, quote, it can twist your testicles, speech given solely by Willoughby.
Now, in the book, Claire was totally in on it.
In the book, Claire was looking over him and Willoughby was kind of peeking in to say, I can help. And they started, yeah, and then they were making the whole, you know, eye contact. Actually, didn't they go out and discuss it together or something?
Yeah, he said he had some Eastern medicine that could help him. And she was like, okay, let's do this. And they went in together. They were in cahoots in the book.
Yeah, exactly. So Claire's the medical professional, not Willoughby. Or at least he hasn't been sold to us as one in the TV series. Not that he can't be, but in the book, they worked together to convince Jamie to use the acupuncture needles.
And do you know who I missed in the adaptation? Murphy. The ship's cook.
The cook?
The cook. He treated Jamie's malady like a personal affront. And it was his challenge that he was going to find something that Jamie was going to be able to keep down. And he had a peg leg. Like he was... He was like quintessential pirate. It was perfect. And I missed Murphy.
It still works what they did, but I think it's more, I think it would be more effective though for Claire or either both of them or Claire to be threatening his testicles. So I think Gary Young does an excellent job in this episode. He was given his lines and he delivered them brilliantly. I have more to say about Willoughby a little bit later. Actually, a shit ton more. Excuse me. Oh, Lord. Oh, it'll be rough. So back in the cabin, Marsali and the Hur, they decide that Hurs deserve bigger beds.
Dude, that was so funny.
I'd be like, fine, I'm the Hur.
Dude, well, she was just like, you know, this is bigger. You won't hit your head in that. And she's like, you don't have to try to get on my eyesight. It's none of my business. And she's like, it's funny. It's none of your business now. And then Claire's like, oh, really? Okay. Well, then I think Hurs get the bigger beds. I thought it was hilarious. That was a well-written
line. It was funny. Okay. So this is where I started to get a little twitchy about Marsali. So Marsali seems to have been nice about giving Claire the larger bed. And Claire says, you don't have to try and get in my good graces, da da da. And this is what I mean by Marsali's not being as innocent as in the book. Her mannerisms and delivery here are very modern, like 2017 modern. Yes, I get that the actress is from 2017, but it's a little too nonchalant or maybe too sarcastic. Do you know what I'm saying? The lines are fine. The gist is good. And she's very sure of herself. That's in character. But Marsali is a bit too sure of herself. Not that she doesn't have words or bad feelings about Claire. She does. But she's a little too, I own the place, and not enough, I hate you and don't even want to engage. Do you know what I mean? She's a spunky character. But 18th century spunky isn't 21st century spunky. Does that make sense?
It does. But could you imagine trying to watch even an hour of that? I think that to play her exactly from the book would have been awful to watch.
Not exactly.
For a long period of time.
Yeah. Claire sees Jamie eating porridge and she's like, oh, you're feeling much better. Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but in the books, I'm not talking about actual acupuncture because I've had it before and I know I don't need it all the time to do whatever. But in the book, didn't it seem like he had it on?
In the books, a lot? I think they were on almost 24/7, like with the exception of sleeping.
That's what I thought.
Given the way that they used the acupuncture, those were some deep ass needles. I don't think that would have worked on screen. Nobody wants to look at that. I was tired of looking at it after one scene. I was like, needles in his face. The acupuncture I've seen in the past is where they kind of tap them in and they barely go in your skin. I've never seen that deep of acupuncture before, but I am not an expert.
No, neither am I. I've had it done. I even had it done in my face. But I was just wanting a refresher. And this is not a complaint about the adaptation. I'm just curious. Am I misremembering it? But yeah, so you had the same feeling that he had them on almost all the time.
Maybe not all the time, but he had them on a lot. Like he left the cabin with them in his face and his ears.
So Fergus and Marsali try again. Fergus says he has told Marsali and Marsali knows all about his seasonal ladies. Aside, Claire tells Jamie that she also thinks that it might fizzle out. So the quickest way to do so is to not fight them. Fighting it will make them cling to it longer, but Jamie can't support it. Even the way Marsali looks at Claire and holds her arms out like WTF. Claire speaks up for them and Marsali gives her a look like, wait, you're actually going to be nice about this or whatever. And then Claire takes Jamie aside. Jamie comes back and is like, sorry, nope, can't do this. And Marsali looks at Claire like it's all her fault.
Well, she doesn't know what she said when she took him aside. So as far as she knows, well, she saw that, but she doesn't know what happened when they walked away. Then we don't know what conversation they had in the room, if any, before they came back.
So this is not good. I love the adaptation of Mr. Willoughby's writing with water on the deck. It's much more likely than the paper that appeared out of the blue. And I love that it dries and disappears. Mm. It's actually much more poetic and much more beautiful. The music under these intimate moments with Mr. Willoughby is gorgeous. And he says it's a poem. Willoughby pulls out a scroll and says that it's the story of his life. He says when he pulls out the scroll that a story told is a life lived. And he won't tell her just yet because once he does, he says he has to let it go. And I thought that was an interesting choice. But cool. So they have like the there's like no wind.
Yeah, that was
no. That wasn't from the book, but it was a nice. It gave them more time. I think it was a very cool idea. So they have weeks and weeks of no wind. Claire still is tending minor injuries and making medicine, and she actually likes this time at sea. Then Claire walks in on Jamie and Mr. Willoughby doing the needles like.
Make it sound naughty.
It's a shame. She recognizes what it is. She says she knows what acupuncture is.
He's getting his medicine from somebody else.
And they've been on board for 3 weeks, we find out. So this is I think the first time I had like a twitch about something. And Marsali was nothing really. This is what doesn't make sense. So Jamie did not want to tell Claire because he didn't want to hurt her feelings. That's, again, not in character. No matter what fight they were having or how much trouble, it's further away from character. He should be telling her more about his ills. Her doctoring him could bring them closer. He says, I didn't want you to see it as more proof you don't belong here. What was that? So rather than...
She's been saying she doesn't belong there.
Exactly.
Because of you know, the changes that he has undergone.
Well, is it keeping that secret and have her walk in on him? Show her that he doesn't need her in this way? I mean, tell her, but first of all, there's nothing bad about it. Second of all, it's not necessarily a lie. He's not saying, no, Willoughby is not treating me. But why? It's so, to me, it's stupid. It's something.
Claire thought it was stupid too and didn't get mad about it. So you're going to have to let it go.
No, she was just, exactly. She was just like, this is silly. I'm not talking about like how she reacted. I'm talking about what a silly choice. Rather than trying to keep things from her, which is what made her want to leave in the first place, you should be telling her things. Okay, onward. So he notices that they aren't moving. And cue the no wind.
I think it's funny that the things that bothered you about the episode are completely opposite than the things that bothered me.
Oh, well, we're not done.
I know. But the things that bothered me is that, to begin with, is the fact that, yes, they talked about superstitions and things in the book, but I don't think we had to make a whole episode about it. And they drove the entire episode around things that didn't happen. That didn't happen. They weren't stalled in the water for weeks with no wind. I mean, there are lots of things that did happen in the book that can be recalled. I don't remember that happening. Did that happen? Am I wrong?
No, I don't remember it.
So it's the problem. Not the problem is a strong word because
we're both finding different things. that's funny.
And I feel like inventing problems when there were plenty of problems in the book and creating issues that weren't issues goes back to my problem with the episode about the Black Watch. What did we have to lose from the book to make room for that episode? And there was a lot of stuff in this episode that was directly from the book. So I get happy when I see all of those things. But then when they spend, half an hour on there being no wind and it all being about superstitions and the superstition and they're going to throw somebody overboard, they built an episode around that, basically. And cut what got chopped because of that? That's what bothers me.
Well, we may never know. We may never know. Okay, so the wind has died, and now we have the literal doldrums from the title. So Jamie, when they're in the room and he's like, oh my gosh, what's going on? We're not moving. They rush up to the deck and he still has his pins in his face. People freak out about the pins a little bit. Mr. Willoughby takes them out.
I mean, Let's be honest. If we have superstitions about having chicks and redheads on board, there has to be some sort of built-in superstition about having a Hellraiser.
About Hellraiser? Exactly. Seriously. So sailors think the wind has stopped due to bad luck caused by themselves, specifically one person not touching the horseshoe. Captain Rains does his best to keep them calm. And I thought Captain Rains did a really good job. He did his best until the end when he's like, well, we got to blame somebody. Someone's got to go overboard. Right. Anyway, so Jamie and Claire have a moment on deck alone. This is later that evening or some evening during the doldrums under the moon. And I loved this.
Me too.
Claire mentions in her time that people had flown to the moon. She says it's rocky and barren and there's no life at all. But she says it's beautiful. And Jamie calls it the man in the moon. And then getting all schmoozy and recollecting on her time in Boston, Claire starts to recite Goodnight Moon.
I totally looked up when that book came out.
Me too. I was like, what? I had no idea this book was that old. So according, do you want to say how old it is?
It was first published September 3rd of 1947.
An American children's picture book written by Margaret Wise Brown. And no idea that it was that old. That's pretty awesome. Now, the music that starts up here is haunting. It is not the love theme, but it has hints of it. It sounds like it's going to be the love theme, but it's not. But it has hints of it. It's really, really pretty.
It's their boat love theme.
Oh, gosh. It's their doldrum theme. So they connect over the missing of their bairn. Here we have the metaphorical doldrums from that definition I read earlier, quote, low pressure areas where the prevailing winds are calm, unquote. So here they are literally together and the pressure is low, right? No high pressure, meaning like no anger, no throwing things, no shooting,
right?
No lies. And they are calm, literally, like the calm winds, like no, like the sea is calm, there's no wind, and they are literally calm. So metaphorical doldrums. So calm winds can be a problem for ship sailing. I didn't even think about it. Obviously, you think you need a wind to sail. I mean, that makes sense, duh. But I never would have thought like what the opposite meant. I never thought that far ahead.
Well, you think of ships now having motors, so they have backups.
Yeah, exactly. So the water's gone bad. Their supply of fresh water isn't very big anymore, and the captain says that they're going to go to half rations. The men, however, hearing this and seeing, so now you have the doldrums, so lack of wind, you have the water supply that's gone bad, and you have the fact that everyone's going to be literally affected now by going on half rations to wait out the doldrums. The men are like, this has got to stop.
They're going to be hangry. They're all going to be hangry.
Yeah, they're going to be hangry, and we have got to find this person who did this or didn't do it and get rid of them. That's the only way for us to balance this out. And at this point, they're insinuating it's Hayes. So at the captain's table, Claire again speaks facts. Captain speaks for the sailors. He says, whom shall we blame? And this is kind of old world versus Age of Enlightenment. Same as when Claire was in France. And then I wrote, heck, same as when Claire was in Scotland. Pretty much wherever she has been in the 18th century. Jamie steps in and says they will throw none of his men overboard. Now, they keep you caught that, right? And Claire even at one point says there is no Jonah. They keep calling Hayes Jonah. That is not his name.
Right. I'm thinking Jonah and the whale, like they're going to throw him off the ship and
exactly. That's what I thought.
He eat him.
Yes. And so stressed out. I do feel bad for Hayes. So stressed out is Hayes and so affected by all of this blame going on that he actually is now afraid that he maybe actually truly didn't touch the horseshoe. He's not sure anymore.
I went back and watched the second time through and I was like, did he? Did he? But they didn't They didn't show him touching it. So maybe he didn't, but I don't know. A lot of people touched it off screen.
So Hayes climbs up climbs up the part of the sail ship thingy that you can climb. And he's up there and he's like, I'm gonna do it, whatever. He's like threatening. It's kind of weird, but he's drunk and he's ready basically to sacrifice himself to just get everything over with. He's had enough. He's so stressed out. And Jamie, I wrote Jamie to the rescue. He climbs up the sail or whatever that climby thing is to meet Hayes and talk him down. Claire is not happy about this. She tells the captain that he has to stop it. Jamie brings up Ardsmuir. He is trying to literally talk Hayes down. Mm. He wants to evoke their time together and how he helped care for all of the men. So he, you know, look, you can trust me. I was there. We were there together. We survived this. You can do this, this kind of thing. Meanwhile, Willoughby is watching a bird soar low over the water. Now he's onto something. Now, Summer, was the first time you saw this, did you think, oh, is that a pelican?
I thought, ping on. And then I thought, and then as I was watching the episode further, I was like, I feel like this is the only reference. This is an Easter egg to ping on, and we will not get a ping on.
As much as I love, I thought Diana said there was a ping on. So
there was.
We'll see.
We saw him flying low over the ocean.
I think if we do get him, that'll be awesome. If we don't get a ping on, it was like, that has to be like some trick bird, because it was a little too coincidental. It was a part of the Willoughby package that I think they're trying to do away with, like having him just like, I don't know. I don't think we're going to get, I don't know. I think we're going to get ping on. I don't, but I don't know. Maybe it doesn't make sense to have him unless he does the thing he does in the books. I don't know. We'll have to see. So Willoughby's onto something. Just as Hayes agrees to get down, he grabs Jamie's arm and is swaying over the ship in danger of falling as they're climbing down. So basically, Jamie like grabs his hand. He tries to go forward. He falls down. He finally gets onto the rope area and they begin their climb
the
down. Yeah, that gets ready. Willoughby writes some characters on the deck in water.
But did you notice what was happening? Because the first time he did that, they evaporated almost immediately. And this time when he wrote them down, they didn't. Did you notice that?
Oh, he was waiting. He was waiting until
how,
the humidity
to see how
got
dry. The air was.
Yes, exactly. No, that's true. It was not only more practical than having paper. It had it played into the doldrum theme very well. I loved it. I loved the whole writing thing. I thought was excellent. So they're down. The mob begins again, and just as they erupt into fighting, Willoughby rings the ship's bell, getting everyone's attention. This is Willoughby's tale. He tells his tale. He is skilled in composition. When he was young, he gained the attention of the emperor's second wife. She wanted him to join her household, but all people who served emperor's wives had to be eunuchs. So it was dishonorable to refuse the emperor's wife, and also a sort of death sentence. He had fallen in love with woman. All woman. I wrote, there's no mention of feet, but lots of talk right. About mounds.
And fruit.
I was surprised. Yeah. I was surprised that Fergus didn't end up covering up Marsali's ears.
I think that level of poetry was over her head.
I don't know. She seemed, I don't know. I'm not convinced. So he fled on the night of lanterns and is now, he says, so he, real quick, we don't get like really too much about how danger he was in. I mean, there was danger, yes. But it's a very truncated version of his story. It hits all the main points. Mm-hmm. And now he says he's in a place, and he meant Scotland, but mostly he means among the white, or among Europeans. He's in a place where he is seen as unworthy of love. His speech, the clucking of hens, his poetry, basically chicken scratches, or his writing, chicken scratches. And he calls the women coarse. Now, in the book, they freaked out about that. They're like, how dare you?
Well, no, they didn't say that. Didn't he edit it? Didn't Jamie edit it? Because he was translating the whole thing.
Ah, maybe, yeah. But he does say that he is basically so low and thought of so lowly that like not even the lowest whore will lay with him. So this is my biggest problem with this episode. Everything else is nothing. I get the use of Willoughby and his speech to save Hayes and possibly Jamie's life.
Yeah, to stop the mutiny.
And to stop the mutiny, add it on.
Especially since he did his little testing, saw the bird, knew that a storm was coming, and was like, if I don't stop this before the storm hits, we're going to lose somebody. And if I can just hold it off for another 15 to 20 minutes, we're going to see a change in the weather.
I get it. I'm not even talking about the timing. This is not about the timing, not about the use. I get that it was used for this purpose. I thought it was, I loved it. He timed it well to detract the attention from the fight and to stop it. And of course, timing for the air and the wind to come back up and the rain. And Gary Young delivers it beautifully. But so much care has been taken to not have Willoughby be or appear to be as he is in the books. Not only how he acts, but how he's treated. Both sides, right? Mm-hmm. They've dealt with the character of Willoughby with such kid gloves that to me, this speech is almost meaningless. It's not half as meaningful as it is in the book. Yes, we get his story, but it was so meaningful and shocking in the book precisely because of how he was treated by others. Diana wrote it that way. I'm not defending it. I'm saying it was effective. To soften the character of Willoughby so much, or at least the way he was treated by others, except the one time when we first meet him in the pub with the whore saying he licked my elbow and didn't pay me. Except for that, we don't ever see Willoughby mistreated. And I'm not talking about whipped or beaten or called terrible names, you know, whatever. But we don't see it. And because we don't see it, I don't doubt that people, you know, strangers who looked differently would have been treated awfully back then. I'm not saying they wouldn't have been, but we don't see it. And because we don't see it, to me, that speech is simply not effective. Nothing like it is in the book. I will always love Willoughby for what he represents and what they chose to keep, the artistry, and of course in the book what they didn't keep, the healthy balls, the acupuncture, his medical knowledge, which helps Claire out in the future. But by not having people react more harshly to Willoughby, and I don't mean today, I mean throughout since we've met him, his anger and passion seem misplaced. I don't disagree. I'm just saying the way they adapted him, or at least adapt him the same way you did, but have the people surrounding him treat him a little more like Shitsky. You see what I'm trying to say, Summer?
I see what you're trying to say, but I have book blinders and I'm just glad they kept it.
I'm glad.
I wish they'd done it with Jamie translating and him speaking it and editing as it went.
That could have been hysterical.
But I was dissatisfied with the physical doldrums because I don't, you know, I think that it was, and maybe it was supposed to make us feel that way, that it was a waste of time. But, you know, I thought that they used it effectively. But again, I'm just glad they kept it because they didn't have to. They didn't even have to keep that character, to be honest.
That's true. Once they got rid of something, well, no, they only needed him. And I guess they could have done it somehow, some other way. I don't know. But for the acupuncture needles. But the few times we've seen Willoughby in the show, not in the books, were like at the brothel, after the fire, on the street, or here on the ship. He hasn't been harassed. Now, I'm not pro-harassment. Maybe he's been ignored, but we haven't seen him mistreated as we did in the book. Is this important? I think so. Because his passion right now is seemingly coming almost out of nowhere. Not out of nowhere for the character. The character is much more than the few scenes we've seen him in. But I was like, wait, did I miss something? Who's making fun of you? Who thinks your speech is odd? Who thinks your calligraphy is not beautiful? You know what I'm trying to say? We get none of that. From his passion, we get the fact that obviously it must have happened, but it is not represented. They have not represented that in this show, period. Except for one whore.
Well, but I mean, what they did show with the whore in the brothel.
That's one time.
When I know it was one time, but you don't have to see something over and over again to understand that that's the way that things go. They don't. It would be bad if they showed it over and over and over again, because then you would say, okay, I get it.
Not over and over. More than once, maybe. More than once, maybe.
No, but it's indicative. The fact that she's like, everyone knew who he was. He was up to his same old shenanigans. They said all of those things. He'd been drinking too much and he was up to his same old shenanigans down at the brothel implies that he does this a lot. And then the girl would do nothing more than let him touch her elbow. Like that was the apex of what she was going to allow him to do. And she didn't have nice things to say about him. I mean, I bet you he had enough money that he could have betted her for her normal price. But because it was him, she wasn't going to do it.
I don't disagree. But even on the ship, they've been there how many? Like weeks now, 3 weeks at least. Not one person looked at him cross-eyed. Yes, I know Jamie was his protector. But in the book, he was made fun of. He was not treated nicely on that ship. And you're telling me that women and redheads are ill luck? What about some foreigner? I'm just saying they could have wrapped that up into the bad luck thing and they could have ignored him. And that would have been like at least, you know, something along these lines. I think the character of Willoughby was treated beautifully, handled beautifully. I love the speech. Like you said, I'm glad they kept it. But the one thing and the one scene when we first get introduced to him saying that, oh, you know, he licked my elbow and then he didn't pay. I mean, it was hysterical. It was funny. I thought it was in character. But that was the only person we've seen. Only person. mistreat him or be odd or gross or mean or awful to him. No, I don't think we needed 87 examples of that. But these sailors should, there should have been some reaction. Now, maybe there was more that they cut out. Who knows? But I am just not, I'm buying his passion, but I'm not buying it as a viewer that we have been convinced enough that he has been mistreated. I believe he has been, but I've read the book and I believe the character. To me, it's just not there, period. So I think it was a great monologue, but not effective because the lead up just wasn't there. And I don't mean specifically the cause. The cause was great. His timing, as Summer said, he was doing writing with the water, waiting for the humidity, getting for the rain. That was brilliant. I did love that. I thought that was great. I'm not talking about that timing. I'm just talking about the lead up wasn't effective, meaning every time we've seen him, his interactions or being around other people, he's basically accepted everywhere. And that I don't believe that was done well. So I love him throwing his life story overboard and having to literally let it go. What did you think about that?
I thought it was an effective move because it also showed the wind had picked up.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. It was perfect timing. It was like magic. Goodness.
He had such a lovely sense of theatricality. So I mean, and maybe that stems from his background as a poet.
Yeah.
That he is a passionate with a hint of dramatic flair. I thought it was a well thought out, well executed plan by Willoughby.
I agree. Willoughby, it did good. And I love the timing, like I said, since he knew the wind was coming. That was great. I think that was an awesome adaptation and addition. If they only had a few more times when he was treated terribly, this would make sense. And of course, I would have believed it. So yay wind and yay rain. Woohoo! So Jamie and Claire are under the deck together as everybody else is upstairs, like dancing in the rain, basically, and collecting the rain. And as they're together, there is the love theme. And they are getting hotsy patatsy.
I said, wind, rain, and Randy.
Now, this is what Summer was alluding to, but or was talking about, but she didn't say this part. And I'm glad because this, I wrote it all in caps. And this is going to be really weird that you guys think I'm so happy for this. But as Summer said, we finally get to see them a lot of times outdoors where they squint or do different things. And we get to see them. Now they look like they've aged a little bit. And when they're just lying there, you know, like outdoors, or lying there together among the bundle or whatever, and there's some kind of sunlight or some kind of light, you see the gray in her hair. And I lost my shiz. I was like, yes, this is a Claire I've been longing to see. The one that we have the rest of the books this summer. This makes me so, so happy. I definitely got a tear prick here.
At their doing it on the boat with the music?
No, I just said, when we see her gray hair.
I had thoughts about that. And
you were not even listening to me.
I was looking something up. Sorry. I was looking something up in the book.
Oh, Lord.
I had to look it up because when she dyed her hair before she left, I was like, that's not going to grow out well. Because I, as someone who has been dyeing gray hair for a very long time, since I was 20, if you dye your hair, it does not gradually grow back out and fade out to a lovely gray where you're all of a sudden you have all your gray hair again. It grows back in a brick. So you have this line of definition between dyed hair and undyed hair, where you will always see now the gray has a stopping point. So you have dark, it's like, you know, and it's a long time before that starts to look kind of natural. And I guarantee there's a woman at my work. I'm not going to say her name. She has beautiful silver hair. And when I started working there, she had silver hair till about the last 3 inches. And the last 3 inches of her hair, and it was about shoulder length, the last 3 inches of her hair was black. So at some point, she had dyed all of her hair black and was now, and it was almost all silver now. And now she was growing it out. And the commitment to go, and I, because of how long it takes my hair to grow, but the commitment this woman had to growing her hair out from dyeing it completely black, permanent black, to back to her gray hair, to long enough to where she could cut it off and have gray hair, which she does now, or silver hair. The commitment to that is something that I think she is a stronger, braver woman than I will ever be. But because she literally had, so she was trying to get shoulder length hair, which she has now. So she was growing it out, but she had this brick of black 3 inches of black along the bottom of her hair. So that's what I was expecting, realistically. Well, I knew they weren't going to do it. But I'm like, if she dyed her hair, that's what was going to grow back out. Silver to a degree, and then the dyed hair until it grew all the way out. However, then I started thinking, and I said, unless she's using semi-permanent hair color, which, you know, might fade more. So I did some research, and Lady Clairol started making semi-permanent hair color in the 1960s. So she must have used semi-permanent hair color. I'm going to go with that, even though I don't think she should have dyed her hair in the first place. But I'm going to say she did with semi-permanent hair color, and it is slowly, slowly washed and faded back out, which is why she's left with her gray.
That makes sense. So Summer has solved the gray hair problem.
I did.
The Claire hair problem.
I did. Did you notice when he says about her silvery hair, and he's like, oh, I would have loved the silver like the moon, and da 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 da. And she's like, oh. She's like, if you had said those things to someone in the 60s, they'd have thought you the king of men. I went, wink, wink, nudge, nudge.
I mean, I heard the king. Yeah, I heard it.
Because they always allude to, and the writers have been calling him the king of men since they started. And I'm sure other people have called him that before. But for her to say that, I was just like, rah, rah.
Cracking up.
Yeah, I
was like, Okay, so then he says, no matter what, this, what is between us, never changes. So I love that. So then it is daylight, and they are being pursued by a British man of war. Now that's a big boat, a big ship. It's called the Porpoise, which makes book readers go, ah! Now the Porpoise fires a signal, and Jamie's like, they're firing at us. And Captain's like, no, he's signaling us. They want aboard. So they're shorthanded, and they're afraid they might be trying to press sailors of the Artemis into service, which they can do to British subjects, of which Jamie is one. In case Jamie is pressed or something happens and they're separated, she promises to continue on to find young Ian. How ironic, then, dot, dot, dot. So Captain Leonard boards. He's very young, the poor lad. He needs a surgeon, he says. They have an outbreak of infectious plague, he calls it. Now, Captain, he says, the original captain and senior officers all died, as well as their surgeon. He's asking for medical assistance at this point, not for sailors. He's like, I can barely, I need to keep alive the ones that I have. Now I don't need any more, you know, mouths to feed. And the blazing shits may be the best line of the season.
Right? I went, but again, I'm a 13-year-old boy in my sense.
That's true. So Summer's a robot unless it's the blazing shits or something like that. Then she
poop and humor, and I'm the first one to laugh.
Oh, Lord. There's some bleepers. Okay. So Claire wants to go aboard just for a bit to be able to, you know, diagnose. She already believes she knows what it is, but she wants to see it so she can firmly diagnose it and help get them started on how to treat this, or at least keep it from spreading. She says she can't catch it and she's been inoculated, and she reminds Jamie of her oath, and he gets it right there and forevermore. Forevermore. So Jamie's fingers all tapping away while Claire is being rowed to the Porpoise. And she's taken to the room of the blazing shits. Actually, it's probably the room of the nasty vomits, because we heard that more than anything. Katrina gives really good stink face. Now, once she's looked around and examined some men, she confirms what exactly it is. It's typhoid. And she instructs Captain Leonard on how to stop the spread and how to contain it. She says she agrees to stay a bit longer to help them get organized, and he's grateful for that. Now, Captain Leonard, what she didn't say was that you could keep her on board and sail away, sail away, sail away.
All right, Anya. Look, here's the thing. In the book, they did not, like, he didn't even care if she knew how to fix it. He didn't wait for her to figure out how to fix it. He didn't wait for her to
off?
He just took off. He didn't even wait for her to fully diagnose it. No, he didn't ask her if she knew how to fix it. He's just like, look, we need a surgeon. You're a surgeon. We'll get, you know, she didn't have a chance to make the plans with Elias Pound. She didn't have any of those things set out before he sent out the word. She was literally down underneath the ground, underneath the where all the sick people were, and he took off.
I'm glad we have our show. They did a pretty darn, they do an excellent job. I'm not, you know, for an adaptation, we are so blessed. It's ridiculous. However, this is an example of, in line with Willoughby, I'm all for not being racist, okay? I'm all for that. But in trying to soften things, and maybe this is not, that was not, maybe this was absolutely not trying to soften it, but why not just have her on the ship and then take off? And then, you know, I don't know. I guess they wanted to make it more.
Well, I'll tell you why. Because they wanted that to be the final moment.
Oh,
that was clearly their button. So that's why. Okay. So
that's true. I can. So it's drama totally driven.
It's drama driven. For sure.
Okay, then doesn't matter. I do get that. I will forgive. Again, who cares what I think? Nobody. But I can, as a viewer, I can forgive a lot for the sake of drama. Because I get it. They need timing and drama, and they can't like just cut it off right there as she's sailing away.
They need a button. They always need a button.
Yeah. So basically, she starts to list out all the things that she'll need, and they say to her, they'll let the Artemis know that she'll be a little bit longer, a little bit late. Now, she has words with the ship's chef, who doesn't like her in his kitchen when the ship's...
Did you hear the goats?
No! Oh!
I heard goats. Monica! I heard goats, and I saw chickens.
Oh, that makes me so happy. And you guys are going like, what? She's happy with goats? It's in the
I
book.
I heard goats,
it's
and I saw chickens. That makes...
So. Oh, well... Oh, then I know. Okay, I remember what happens with the goats, the goat lady. So she's in with the ship's chef, who doesn't like her in his kitchen when the ship starts to move. And they're pulling up the anchor. They are basically kidnapping Claire. Now, he's trying to reassure her, like, look, it's all good. We're both going to Jamaica. You'll end up right. together. And then, of course, that's, again, the drama driven. Slight change there. And I love the drums at the end. Like, the outro is, like, almost pure drums. So, people, we're started. We're definitely on.
I'm just going to say one thing. Y'all, don't get used to Elias Pound.
Why would you say that?
Because.
I mean, he's not a main character or anything, but.
Exactly. He just made me sad when they were like, Elias Pound.
And I was like, oh.
I know. He's supposed to. He's even younger than the 19-year-old captain.
So much. Okay. So, that was 309.
That was 309. Join us next week when we discuss chapter, listen to me, when we discuss episode 310 entitled Heaven and Earth.
Thank you as always so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod.